think we're up against something more powerful and destructive than either of you realize.
I don't care where you've come from. I've only seen you as a woman, not as anything else.
But I am something else.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. All along the watchtower of Bristol city walls tonight, briefing number one on surveillance. Doing a series over the next few weeks on authoritarian Britain, examining the building blocks of the police state being assembled around us. Journalist Kevin Carhill's here to look at the criminality behind the Snowden revelations and the echoes of the Nazi profiling of the 1930s that was to lead to mass rounding up of humans across Europe based on their ethnicity and their beliefs. Also, the religion of war. We look back at the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, what Anthony Hall's suspended professor from Canada makes of it, and how hollow Bush's words now seem. And alongside this surveillance theme, the brave new technocratic world, where did we hear that before? Tonight, through the eyes of author Aldous Huxley. Stuart Griffiths is on our sister show Dialect here on BCFN at noon on Tuesday. He's a para from Northern Ireland that turned into a paparazzi photographer. He's now up at the University of Belfast with a scholarship there. Also on Tuesday, we've got Manfred Petrisch, the All Smoke and Mirrors blog in German, talking about the Trump victory and some of the things he's sussed out from that. That's on our sister show Dialect here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday, online at dialectradio.co.uk, also bcfmradio.com/dialect. But first, Martin and Kevin, I'm joined by Martin Summers and Kevin Carhill. Let's have a little discussion about this guy, Michael Flynn, who it looks like Trump is going to be having as his national security advisor. What do you make of him, Kevin?
Well, he's the guy who resigned, James Clapper, is a fascist, plain and simple.
But okay, what do you mean when you say that? What makes you say that?
Well, the media today were full of the fact that he lied to Congress. He's also the person who bounced David Cameron when he tried to stop American surveillance in Britain. Clapper persuaded Obama to maintain it and not let the Brits off the hook. Flynn was bounced out of his job by Clapper. And Flynn comes from much the same mold. He is essentially a military fascist. He doesn't believe in the rights of anybody outside America, for sure, but whether he even believes in American constitutional rights is so far unclear.
Martin?
Yeah, I mean, I'm prepared to admit that these people, from our point of view, are not savoury folk. But I think that Flynn being forced out was a symbol of the fight that's going on within the military establishment in the US, because Flynn was outspokenly against the policy of supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and basically of the opinion that the attempt to overthrow Assad was misconceived. So he leaked his own DIA's report into the foundation of ISIS and where ISIS came from, and he was interviewed live, and he said, well, we basically let it happen, wink wink, we made it happen. So I think appointment of Flynn, and of course Flynn then having been forced out of his job, then reappears in Russia at the Russia Today 10th anniversary dinner sitting next to Putin, and now he's sitting next to Trump. So I can imagine there's some conniptions going on amongst those who are keen on an overthrow Assad policy, because it's a fairly clear signal from Trump that he's not going to go down that road.
Well, can I be cynical? And what Putin would love is what the Americans have got, and it's called PRISM. It's the mass surveillance program they run throughout the world. And Putin would love to have that and access to it.
Well, he doesn't have his own version, but he doesn't tell anybody about it, does he?
Well, the second thing is the strategic issue. If you're going to be equaled and probably overtaken by China, what should you look for? Another power to back you up. This is making more strategic sense than it seems.
The other thing, of course, it's possible, Kevin, is that somehow the Russians have got some kind of back-end, back-door into PRISM, so that as the Americans think that they're looking at everything, the Russians may be looking at it too. The difference is that our side is very leaky, and that may simply be because people who are sworn to secrecy over in our part of the world are sitting and thinking, well, actually, I don't really believe in this anymore, because I think that this is morally bankrupt, the way that the West has been, for example, interfering in the Middle East, that kind of thing. So there is this kind of moral conscience comes in to almost every human being that's involved in this whole military machine, which may be simply one of the reasons why they're going over to drones so much, because the drones just do what they're told by the computer.
Yeah. Well, but one of the things that really shocked me recently was I saw both the movie, if you like, about the hunt for Osama bin Laden and the documentary. These guys, the 16 different intelligence agencies, wait for this, took 10 years to find him. That's the first thing. The second thing is, 18 months after they had photographs of his house and pictures of him, it took them 18 months to catch up with him. Now, what's all this technology about? If it's clearly not working for the purposes that the Americans claim, and our own people too, it's not being used to catch terrorists. If it takes 10 years, that's a failure. That's not a success. And that's what bothers me. They're obviously focusing on something else, and that's us.
Redress online, redress information and analysis, exposing injustice, disinformation and bigotry, they say. Quite a good little alternative information site. I'll ask both of you this because it's quite important. Trump, Kevin, it says, may kill Netanyahu with kindness, although Trump, for now at least, seems like a dream come true for Israel's Netanyahu. Jonathan Cook says he could ultimately turn Israel into a pariah state in Western capitals and leave it exposed strategically.
It's hard to know how Trump is going to deal with Netanyahu, but they are birds of a feather emotionally and politically. They're both extreme right wingers. They're both fascists, and either give a toss for personal or human rights.
Netanyahu, elected four times, Martin, has always faced off with Democratic incumbents. Now he's only a right-wing Republican at the White House, but a right-wing dominated Congress too. Standing guard over the relationship will be Sheldon Adelson. You talk about him from time to time, don't you? US casino magnate, who's Netanyahu's most vocal supporter.
Yeah, well, I mean, Trump at one stage in the Republican primaries was saying that he was going to be even-handed in his approach to the Palestinian-Israeli problem. But, of course, he then sold that out completely. And, you know, basically, in order to be president of the US, Democrat or Republican, you've got to basically promise the Israelis anything they want. It may well be the case also, picking up on what Kevin was saying about Flynn, is that Trump has basically said he's going to have a trade war with China, and if you're going to do that, then you've got to make nice to the Russians. And, of course, the idea of picking on the Russians and the Chinese simultaneously is a pretty... I mean, Kissinger thinks that's a pretty dumb policy, and it probably is a pretty dumb policy, but that's what the previous administration was trying to do.
Well, one of the other things Jonathan Cook in Nazareth is saying here is that the Trump policy statement issued just before the election could have been written by Netanyahu himself. He says Trump has backed moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a move that, if implemented, would make the US the first Western state to recognise Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Now, this could be a bit controversial, Kevin, couldn't it?
Yeah. I faced that.
Well, myself, in Who Owns the World, I said the capital of Israel was Tel Aviv, and I got a letter from the ambassador inviting me to pulp the book and change it. So I said, so long as the British government describes it as Tel Aviv, that's who I follow.
Martin, what do you make of the future for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict under Trump?
Well, I mean, Trump has said some more sensible things about Syria than you've got from some of the more liberal politicians in the US, but at the same time he's beholden to special interests. In order to become US president, you've basically got to promise people like Sheldon Adelson that you're going to play ball. I mean, Sheldon Adelson basically at one stage, and he's the biggest funder of US politics, he basically, Trump had to square him in order to get him behind him.
So who is this guy? Casino magnet. He's basically
magnet.
In charge,
casino
isn't he?
Casino magnet, but he's also very, very pro-Israeli.
Chips for everyone.
I mean, these are the people that are the real playmakers in US politics.
But one of the things Trump said during the campaign that was odd and suggested to me he wasn't briefed, he said he would dismantle, get rid of NATO if they didn't pay up. And he doesn't seem to understand that most NATO countries spend a fortune in the United States buying American weapons. And one of the reasons they do that is because Russia is supposed to be a threat. So he's got a little tangle there too.
Well, look, staying with the whole Israel-Palestine thing, Jerusalemites says the Middle East Monitor memo are reciting a call to prayer tonight from their rooftops. Residents can clearly be heard reciting the call to prayer in protest of the law tonight. In response to the Israeli government's plan to prohibit the call to prayer in Jerusalem, Jerusalemites have climbed onto the rooftops of their houses and recited the call to prayer altogether. Video footage which is circulating on social media, residents can clearly be heard reciting the call to prayer in protest of the law to ban it in Jerusalem. Churches in Nazareth showed solidarity by broadcasting the call to the night prayer in response to attempts to prohibit it being broadcast from Al-Aqsa Mosque. Over the past 2 weeks, Israel's been working to ban the Muslim call to prayer. The Athan, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, supported the bill to outlaw the religious calling, saying Israel is a state that respects the freedom of worship for all believers and is committed to protecting those who suffer from noise, which is caused by the loudspeakers, Martin.
Yeah, well, the question is, what, you know, they've been moving people into East Jerusalem for years, and they're trying to surround it completely. Why have they got the decision to who is not allowed to call to prayer in Jerusalem?
Well, it's interesting because the Chinese,
because they took it by force.
The Chinese have been saying that East Jerusalem should be the capital of the Palestinian state.
Well, indeed, and the attempt to make Jerusalem into, I mean, that is what the right wing in Israel have been pushing for years, that Jerusalem should be the capital of the state. And in actual fact, in international law, the Israelis should be back behind the 1948 line. That's where they should be, and they shouldn't have control of Jerusalem at all. If we're going to go to war with Russia because they allow a premier to vote to rejoin Russia, why are we allowing Israel to claim that Jerusalem belongs to them when it doesn't belong to them any more than Kosovo belongs to Serbia?
Extreme knee-wobbling piece of news this week. Putin withdraws Russia from the International Criminal Court this week, says Associated Press. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a decree on Wednesday to withdraw Russia from the International Criminal Court, which rules on such grave charges as genocide and crimes against humanity. Russia in 2000 signed the Rome Treaty that established the Hague-based court but never ratified it. Putin's decree published on the Kremlin's website comes a day after the UN General Assembly's Human Rights Committee approved a resolution condemning Russia's occupation of Crimea and blamed Russia for rights abuses such as discrimination against Crimean residents such as the Tatars. Russia annexed Crimea in March 2014 from Ukraine, says Associated Press, following a hastily called referendum move that led to crippling Western sanctions. A separatist insurgency erupted in eastern Ukraine following months backed by the Russians. The ICC on Monday issued a preliminary report. It described what happened in Crimea as an international armed conflict between Ukraine and the Russian Federation. Well, they're not really talking about the referendum much there. We've also heard yesterday the Philippines have pulled out of the International Criminal Court. Sounds to me like the various structures of international law, including the Justice Committee at the UN, Kevin, are just breaking down.
Well, that is one of the really bad signals, because of course the United States never supported the International Court. Now all the tough guys, right-wingers, are all bailing out. There's that lunatic in the Philippines, you know, who launched a bloodbath.
Well, Duterte, I think he was even... Well, I know he was even implicated as running a death squad in previous administrations.
In his own town.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really bad guy. About the Crimea, this is purely on the side. I don't take sides on that one. But everybody seems to forget that the Ukraine was granted the Crimea by Khrushchev one drunken night in the Kremlin, and Khrushchev did not hold a referendum to see if the Crimeans wanted to be transferred to the Ukraine. The history there is very tangled, and the Americans and others are playing it as though there was no history, as though the Crimea hadn't been dumped in the Ukraine by a drunken Khrushchev in a bar one night, well, in the Kremlin one night.
Martin, institutions of international law just falling apart, effectively.
Well, the International Criminal Court came into being at a certain stage of what was going on in international affairs, and the Russians at that stage were prepared to compromise and put their name to it. But of course, the Americans had no intention. They wanted the International Criminal Court. They just didn't want to have their people potentially put in front of it. Because if the International Criminal Court's got to means anything, all these African countries have withdrawn from it, because it's only African leaders who've got an anti-Western background who've ever been convicted by it. And of course, Milosevic died in prison in The Hague, and then they've had to admit that in actual fact they didn't really have a case against him, and that there was no evidence that he was in fact guilty as charged with the crimes that he'd committed. So around the world, the International Criminal Court is, I'm afraid, seen as a Western, Western justice for Western interests.
We've also had several African countries pulling out of it too over the last month or so.
Well, that's right. But that's because the only people who've ever been convicted are people the West doesn't like, and relatively minor people in Africa. I mean, somebody like Kissinger should be going there, but he isn't going to go there, is he?
And what about Netanyahu? What about Bush? What about Bush?
Indeed, and that's why it falls apart, because at the end of the day, there's no agreement about this. When we carry, when we support death squads in Syria, should our people be sent there? And of course, we're not. We've got no intention of sending British military personnel to stand trial for running death squads in Syria, have we?
Now, Tony Blair.
I have to really apologise for not reading this out and not reporting this before the elections in the US. But tax records reveal that Donald Trump donated $100,000 to the Clinton Foundation. This is just literally in August. This was reported by CNN, and then re-reported by others with a much more sort of dumbed down headline by CNN. But $100,000, Kevin, Donald Trump is sending to the Clinton Foundation. Just sound like they're a bit closer than they made out, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, he was a friend of the Clinton. Well, he's always been a friend of anyone who's in power. And but don't forget, he has been elected president without showing up his tax returns. And can I make a tiny forecast? He's going to be shown to be worth a great deal less than $10 billion. He may still be a billionaire when they crop up, but try a billion, not 10. And the Clintons were friends of his. The daughters apparently are still friendly.
Martin?
Well, I mean, the elites in the United States all know each other intimately. And the pretense that there's a huge fight amongst them is just that, a pretense. The real Sheldon Adelson has backed both Hillary and Trump, and he's making sure that his pro-Israeli policies are going to be the policies that are pursued, and that's what you do.
It sounds a bit like Standard Oil and Royal Dutch Shell in World War II, backing Hitler and Churchill.
Well, if you are a big vested interest, that's what you do. You buy all the politicians, not just some of them. You'd be a fool to bet just on one horse, wouldn't you? If you can control the whole race by buying them all.
Kevin, also, we really ought to move on to talk about surveillance, because we've just heard literally today the Investigatory Powers Bill, better known as the Snoopers Charter, is to pass into law, giving government sweeping spying powers. That's what we're looking at today, particularly to do with surveillance, as part of our series on authoritarian Britain. The bill will force internet companies to store all their users' browsing data, and will allow the government to force phone makers to hack into people's handsets, not as if that's not already happening. The House of Lords passed the Investigatory Powers Bill, putting the huge spying powers on their way to becoming law within weeks. The bill, which forces internet companies to keep records on users and and also to hack in and to break things they've sold so they can be spied on. Breaking things sounds a bit strange, though. If they don't like you, then they can just break your phone effectively remotely. It's been fought against by privacy campaigners and technology companies such as Apple and Twitter, but the government worked to continue to pass the bill despite objections. The legislation is not possible to enforce and would make customers unsafe. House of Lords agreement to the next to the text now means it just awaits royal assent, at which point this becomes law. Despite criticism from almost every major technology and internet company, including usually reticent ones like Apple, who got a bit of a bloody nose from the EU, didn't they, a few weeks ago, and senior parliamentary committees, the legislation has received very little opposition in Parliament. Hang on, where are you, our MPs? Nowhere, it seems. Early on, the only amendment that the bill received from MPs was a measure that stopped themselves being spied on. Okay to spy on us, but not them. While Labour's raised objections, it hasn't actually voted against the bill, Kevin.
No, well, the bill has been put into law without the cost, the real bill. Most technology companies are not in a position to store the data now, and if they do store it, it's going to cost a fortune. Most of the American technology companies are ultimately going to face civil lawsuits over PRISM. And of course they don't want to be involved in another set of, you know, surveillance lawsuits. The nine big American internet companies will ultimately pay up something like $250 billion for the surveillance, the illegal surveillance. Now, they're being asked to do the same thing here, except it's supposed to be legitimate. The bill is 283 pages long. It's absurd. There's a principle that's been completely forgotten. If a bill is that long and that big, how can you obey it? And the answer is you can't. The bill is that long to conceal what it's about, which is mass surveillance of the population by the government. And a person who should, one of the people who did an enormous amount to get it through, was David Anderson, the chap who's supposed to review surveillance legislation. He actually made the case for it. He knows in a very special way, and he hasn't actually acknowledged it, he knows that the Americans, under PRISM, spied on children in the UK. And when he was asked about it, he just smiled and walked off.
Okay, so spying on children, this is really turning a basic legal principle on its head, isn't it? Which is the presumption of innocence. Well, basically, you're presumed guilty under this law, and everything that you're doing will be under surveillance, which includes things like passwords. It's nice to see the MPs doing something about putting MPs under surveillance, although I don't know how they're going to be able to check that anything, get any evidence that an MP is under surveillance, whether they are or not. But they've not said anything about lawyers being under surveillance or journalists.
It's a complete joke. Under PRISM, the parliamentary data was stolen. Now, some MPs know this, and one of the ones who has been told about it is Keith Starmer. Have you seen him jumping up and down about the fact that his data in Parliament is being nicked by a foreign spook agency? They haven't defended themselves. How do you expect them to defend us?
Well, what about this turning around of the principle of presumption of innocence? And I suppose the other major thing is that this surveillance has been clearly going on in the past illegally.
Well, one of the things, not from Five, but there have been mumblings, even in the media, from GCHQ and Six, that they don't want this bill. Yeah, sure they don't want it. They know exactly what PRISM was and the hoo-ha that erupted over that. The party that want the bill is Five, the domestic secret police. They want this bill, partly because this is what they've been doing all along, and nobody's caught them, and to give the state the powers that you're saying to treat everybody as guilty first, but above all, to have files on anybody who might be a dissident, who might, you know, be even just the loyal opposition, and to have ways of blackmailing those people into shutting up.
But these are Gestapo powers, effectively.
They are actually Gestapo powers, only the Gestapo had never had powers like this.
So you think this will give the Secret Services more power than the Gestapo had?
Yeah, much more. The Gestapo could target, and there's certain things they could get, but they could not throw a blanket out over the whole population and steal all their records. That's what this bill allows the spooks to do.
Now, Martin, this is worth mentioning that this isn't really something the police have any access. I mean, they've got all sorts of checks and balances and hoops to jump through if the police wanted to do surveillance. Actually, the real people who are able to do this without much trouble, the privatised mobile phone companies, private telecom companies, and the signals intelligence agencies, people like GCHQ, the intelligence agencies, and the communications, the telecoms companies seem to have all the power here. The police actually have got a lot of trouble to even put anybody under surveillance or get, for example, information from Google, from YouTube. I mean, I recently had a death threat on one of my Google channels. The police have still not had any information several months later back from YouTube about who posted it, because YouTube are just not really playing ball with them. So this is a whole nother level above the police that seem to have a far, far greater power than even the police are allowed.
Well, in the original US Constitution, it was made absolutely explicit that the state should only be able to interfere with private communications if there was a reasonable suspicion that a crime had been committed. And this was regarded as a fundamental principle back in the 1770s. We've now got complete blanket surveillance of the population by unaccountable intelligence agencies, many of which are implicated in supporting Islamist terrorism, for example. So the spies are not protecting us. They are also the people that are actually running the capers that they're supposed to be stopping. The police can't get in there, so that in other words, the legitimate role of the civilian police force in looking into crime is not being helped, and the whole thing is essentially a come on for a police state.
Now, Kevin, the obvious thing for the security services and political forces within there to use this for is to simply spy on their political opposition, to disable them before they even get a chance to get running to take them on in politics.
That is what the Americans were using the children's data that they stole under PRISM for, to create files. They would keep all, most of the files being active most of the time, but if the children grew up, became politicians, back to the file to see if they committed any indiscretions when they were kids. And certainly one of the security service have picked up on this. The other two are more chary about it because they're scared of ultimately the cost that the American internet companies are going to have to pay for what they did.
So what's the role of Nosy Parker in all this? This chap, Andrew Parker, is Nosy being very big inverted commas around it. He's the Director General of MI5.
He, interestingly, has never got a knighthood. He's been around the same length of time as the two Lubbin who left GCHQ. So there's something. But when Theresa May was Home Secretary, he would have been in her office most days. So clearly there's a very close relationship between the person who is now the Prime Minister and the secret police, the domestic secret police. The party really pushing to get that bill, and our media have been hopeless, was Five. They wanted that bill desperately, partly to legitimise what they've been doing for years, but most of all to be able to do that kind of surveillance. You know, to surveil out on everybody, but to make the files from when they're young so they can catch them if they ever do anything.
A massive profiling exercise, exactly, yeah. What the Nazis, yeah, were doing in the 1930s. And Martin, Andrew Parker, Nosy Parker, as we love to call him on this show, led MI5's response to the 2005 terrorist attacks in London, overseeing it.
Yeah, well, it was interviewed by The Guardian quite recently, and it was absolutely fawning interview in which he was basically given a free run out by The Guardian's journalists to justify everything that they're pushing for in terms of extra powers and so on and so forth. And
did The Guardian not ask him why there was such a total disaster by MI5 on the London bombings when, yeah, three of the four main alleged bombers were under surveillance by MI5, yeah, in the months running up to those attacks, and yet they still did nothing to stop them?
Well, of course, no, there wasn't, is the simple answer to that. And, of course, my contention is that the intelligence...
And also, sorry, just to add to that, they lied, didn't they? MI5 lied. They said, oh, we never come across these guys at all before. They were clean skins. And when it finally came to court, oh, actually, no, we've been following them for years.
Well, I mean, it's always been my contention that the intelligence services in this country and the US are the main instigators of Islamist terrorism. And nobody disputes that in the 1980s, London and MI6 were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, which funneled jihadi terrorists from all over the world into Pakistan and then into Afghanistan to fight the Russians. Nobody disputes that. Everybody agrees that's what happened. But the story is that at some point, these jihadi networks went rogue and started to bite the hand that fed them. And yet we still have in Syria, as we speak, the British have now taken over the training role for the terrorist networks inside Syria, which the Americans seem to be unwilling to continue with. And that's presumably because that's a way of continuing with those networks when the Americans are now finding it difficult because Trump's taken over. And the track record of our intelligence services actually being implicated in either allowing things to happen, in other words, they're watching things but they don't stop them, or in fact possibly recruiting them. So on your article, which came upon Redress, which was originally written for RT, you pointed out how when the Turkish police arrested the person who'd been grooming British schoolgirls to go and fight in Syria, it turned out he was working for Canadian intelligence. And that's all on the record, although in Turkey itself, the journalists and the police officers involved in that case have all been put on trial for treason by our NATO ally, Turkey. But the evidence is clear.
And then when these poor schoolgirls were taken down to Gaziantep, they were handed over to a British guy.
Indeed. And of course, there was the West Midlands police put a Swedish national on trial at the Old Bailey for intending to go out to Syria to join in the jihadi struggle there. And his defence lawyers argued successfully that he was going to work with an organisation that was supported and trained by British Special Forces and MI6. And at that point, the case was dropped.
Well,
the evidence is all there for people who look at it, that we have been running these jihadi networks all along, at the same time as pretending to fight them. The Russians are pretty clear about that. So are the Syrians.
Okay. Well, this is something. One of the curiosities, too, Martin raised the Guardian interview with Andrew Parker. Pure PR.
Yeah.
Not a single hard question. But there was an earlier interview that nobody seemed to notice. It was, what's he called? Moore. Charles Moore's interview with Sir Ian Lobban. He spent an entire page of the Telegraph saying what a wonderful Director General of GCHQ, Sir Ian Lobban, what a marvellous man, what a wonderful institution. He never asked him why he was leaving it at the age of 53. And the answer was because he was fired. He was pushed out by Malcolm Rifkind because Lobban actually not only authorised but encouraged the Americans to launch PRISM in the United Kingdom and didn't understand it was totally illegal. Repart 1, interception of emails is a criminal offence, and Sir Ian didn't see it that way. Rifkind, who's a QC, did.
So rather than going to jail, he just got the sack?
He just got the sack, and this one page, you know, what a wonderful, tremendous guy he is. But it's just the national media. There's another. Most people in the UK think there's this marvellous student called Schrems who protested, you know, and he got to the European Court and he got a judgment. Wait for this. Nobody has written that his original complaint is still with the Irish regulator and has been postponed for another year. Schrems got to the highest court in Europe and got a judgment in his favour. Meanwhile, his complaint is still stalled in the bureaucracy. Hasn't been investigated.
Well, that seems like similar to the child sex abuse inquiry. There seems to be a lot of things that are being stalled by the bureaucracy, maybe because some of those bureaucrats are criminals themselves and they're trying to cover their posteriors. Anyway, look, Kevin, on to Snowden now, some of the revelations that have come through Snowden.
Yeah.
Things like the PRISM the targeted killing, the drones. I mean, it's interesting. Just the other week, it was a brilliant article in The Observer about Molesworth recruiting people to do drone targeting. I always remember back in the 1980s, there was some kind of... when the peace convoy, all these hippies in their buses, decided to surround RAF Molesworth and broke in and running around. Well, it turns out this is actually one of the most important places in the world for doing these war crimes, effectively targeting people, doing things which effectively... I mean, you know, murder is murder, and we don't have the death penalty in Britain, except it looks like if you step out of Britain, or possibly in some other part of the world, the British government can kill British citizens in other parts of the world using drones. So we've also got, obviously PRISM is the main one, but we've also got other revelations. There's something called Ghost Hunter, which is related to these drone killings, Ghost Wolf, Overhead and Moon Penny. These various code names are now out in the public domain. Very little reporting on it, though, by the London media.
Nope. The Guardian has effectively abandoned reporting on Schrems, the one who won the case, and who's now completely sidelined.
Do you want to just recap on what this case was all about? Is it the Safe Harbour case? Am I right?
No. Schrems objected to PRISM, mass surveillance, and he got a High Court judgment. The Irish regulator told him bugger off, and they used extremely abusive terms. Schrems went to the Irish High Court, got an extraordinary result. The judge said, yeah, you're right. The United States, a whole country, was indicted for mass surveillance, which, as we know, is criminal here. So that was sent to the European Court, who doubled up on it and said, yeah, the United States has been doing mass indiscriminate surveillance. Cancel Safe Harbour. And they threw it out. Now, in the meantime, Schrems's actual complaint is still in Dublin, unmoved and postponed for another year. In other words, people paid the European regulators together, since Snowden revealed the mass surveillance, have been paid 1.5 billion euros, and not one single regulator has even started an investigation for 1.5 billion euros. Nobody. And not one newspaper has pointed this out.
Well, the newspapers are being... I mean, we now live in the world of strategic communications, and a so-called liberal newspaper like The Guardian is the perfect place for MI5 to push its basically lies. And they don't... You know, that's much more effective than having it, for example, in Murdoch's press. And The Guardian have basically allowed themselves to be... I mean, so that they expose Snowden, or, you know, that Snowden and the WikiLeaks revelations, and then in order to try and keep in with the powers that be, they then give Andrew Parker basically a free ride, at their expense. But, and, of course, it's all just a manipulation of our minds.
Don't let's hammer The Guardian. I mean, without The Guardian, we wouldn't have even known about Snowden. But... The Guardian spent two pages on a cop shop in Chicago. And in the meantime, PRISM is possibly still running. The Guardian have not pushed through, nor have anybody else, in fairness. And the BBC have been, you know, another... BBC and the liberal media play PR by not asking questions.
Well, I noticed a couple of stories this week in The Independent online, which were... one of them was about this International Peace Prize Global Peace Award, which was given to the White Helmets and to Joe Cox, the murdered MP, although whether she would actually endorse the White Helmets is a whole other question. It's almost as if she's doing it from beyond the grave without her permission. And there was another article by the same journalist about the Remembrance Sunday and how wonderful that was, and about the British Legion and what a great organisation it was. Now, I just had a little look at her. It turns out she's a food journalist. Her articles are all about food, and the last one was about the world's most expensive kebab, and there she is suddenly pontificating on global affairs, Kevin.
Yeah. No, Schrems got a certain amount of coverage for what he did, but it stopped when he started to become, you know, when his complaint was dangerous. He just got sidelined. Now, I won a quite reasonable judgment in the High Court, the Investigative Powers Tribunal. They invited the police and the regulator to investigate PRISM, and all three refused. But this was public. It wasn't, the hearing was in secret, but the judgment where they sent the invitation and the evidence to the police and the regulator. And this is a very curious setup we've arrived at. The courts make an order, and the police and the regulator say, no chance, bugger off.
Well, it always seems like the law is just not able to keep up with some of these technology firms. Maybe they like it that way. Obviously, they do like it that way. But look, let's just take a step up for a minute now and look at some of these Bilderberg firms. We're talking about Google, who have really taken over from David Rockefeller. Eric Schmidt has on the steering group of the Bilderberg conferences. And firms like, for example, Google DeepMind and Palantir Technologies. Now, these companies are saying basically that they can help governments run things by having massive databases and helping them make all their decisions by just doing a kind of quick database search. We'll tell you what's the best thing to do here. Google DeepMind, one really good article in Bloomberg just yesterday, gives computer dreams to improve learning. Androids may not, as science fiction writer Philip K. Dick once posited, dream of electric sheep, but the newest artificial intelligence system from Google's DeepMind division does indeed dream, metaphorically at least, about finding apples in a maze. Researchers at DeepMind wrote in a paper published online on Thursday this week, they had achieved a leap in the speed and performance of a machine learning system. It was accomplished by, amongst other things, imbuing technology with attributes that function in a way similar to how animals are thought to dream. So the idea being here, of course, that the computers are kind of dreaming up our future, deciding what's best for us.
This is actually what this leads to. But don't forget that these great machines are the ones that took 10 years to find Osama bin Laden. They're that good. So if they're interfering with our dreams and our sleeps, I think no chance. But do you remember the story New Scientist had about the hospital, about Google DeepMind getting the all the data on patients from some hospital in London? But they've never followed it through. Google have never explained, and the hospital have never explained, what the legal authorization for the handover of the data on 1.4 million patients. And neither party have explained to the patients or the public, and New Scientist haven't followed it up.
What about all this data mining, though? Because that seems to me as if what all this surveillance is for is for companies like this, Palantir Technologies, Martin, who are doing something called Gotham, which is this Palantir program which is used by counter-terrorism analysts, offices in the US Department of Defense, and intelligence people in the US, fraud investigators, etc. The idea is that the more information that goes into these organizations and databases, the better. And actually, you can just press a button, basically, and predict where you're going to find all your future criminals.
Well, before modern IT, you could collect loads of information, but you couldn't analyse it. So you'd have masses and masses of files on people, but here we have the time to go through them and find out what was in them. But why they've gone for this is because Echelon used to do this in the old analog days. Is you've actually got the capability now to analyse the information once you've collected it. But of course, as any serious terrorist will tell you, the best way to deal with that is not to go online at all, as I'm sure the Iraqi resistance learned virtually immediately. Incidentally, the assassination, so-called, of Osama bin Laden, Seymour Hersh has pointed out that there's no real evidence that he was there. Nobody in Pakistan believes he was there at all, and most evidence suggests that he died a long time ago. So, you know, we're basically living in Baudrillard's surreal reality, because they've deliberately created.
Okay, you better explain who this Baudrillard is.
Well, Baudrillard was a French social thinker. And
philosopher, nihilist, I think, is it?
Well, no, he was one of these, you know, French intellectual types that people.
Okay, go on.
He said that the first Gulf War was a simulacrum, that it hadn't really happened, that it was basically just a media event. And I think that's when he started to lose his marbles, frankly. He'd said some quite sensible stuff before then. But we do live in a world which is deliberately being created by intelligence agencies and others in order to manipulate our minds so that they can achieve their goals.
We've just had the announcement this week about massive expansion of the BBC World Service, the biggest since the Second World War, in fact. At the same time, cutbacks in BBC monitoring. So what does this tell us? What it tells us is that we're very, very good. We want to broadcast our propaganda, but we're not really interested in what anyone else is saying anymore, Kevin.
No, that's a very dangerous point to get to.
It's almost a psychopath's attitude, where it's like, you must listen to me, but I'm not going to listen to anything else that's going on.
Yeah.
Well, if you believe your own propaganda, you're likely to lose. And that is, of course, the politicians are also the victims of this. So we've seen all this stuff about the White Helmets and Joe Cox here. I mean, this is basically manipulating the political leadership so that they then make decisions which the intelligence services want them to make. But they think they're being independent.
Well, look, one of the great writers on surveillance has got to be the Jewish-American writer Edwin Black. He wrote a book about the transfer agreement as well, which is all about the deals done between the Zionist lobby and the Nazis in order to actually end the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany. But he also wrote a book called IBM and the Holocaust. And here he is speaking in 2009. We'll have a little listen to this then, a discussion afterwards.
I'm here to demonstrate to you why IBM is guilty of genocide and consciously helping to co-plan and co-organize the destruction and murder of millions of people consciously for money. And I brought the documents with me, some of them. And this book, IBM and the Holocaust, and there's a website for it, IBMandtheHolocaust.com, and my own website, EdwinBlack.com, came out 10 years ago, and IBM can't deny it. And the reason they can't deny it is because they know that they consciously engaged in genocide, micromanaged by Thomas J. Watson personally. And so, tomorrow morning, the management of the Endicott Visitor Center will not get a letter of complaint from the IBM legal team. They will get silence. But you will have the benefit of seeing the actual documents, and you'll be able to ask me any questions. So I'm going to explain to you exactly how it happened. When Hitler came to power in January of 1933, January 30th of 1933, his goal was to destroy all the Jews, not only in Germany, but throughout Europe. And this required the resources of a computer. But in 1933, there was no such thing as a computer as we know it today. There was instead the Hollerith punch card system, which stored information on any person, any action, any quantity, any process in the holes that were punched into rows and columns. Those were then subjected to a magnetic reader. And the information could be not counted, but cross-tabulated. IBM owned information technology. They had a monopoly on it. Even the 10% of American information technology that was given to Remington Rand was an expensive license to pretend that they did not have 100% of the market. So, when Hitler came to power, he wanted to destroy the Jews. He wanted to murder them. He wanted to evict them, pauperize them. The only company on earth that could have orchestrated that, organized it, planned it, IBM, under the personal supervision of Thomas J. Watson, did so. They organized custom-made programs to automate all six phases of the Holocaust. The identification of the Jews, their expulsion from society, the confiscation of their assets, the ghettoization, the deportation, even the extermination of the Jews. How did they do it? Well, first Hitler said, we want to know where the Jews are. Some of the Jews were in synagogues. Some of them did not even know they were Jewish because their grandparents had converted to Christianity. They were actually worshiping in churches, in Catholic cathedrals. Some of them were recognizable because they wore traditional religious headgear. Others looked like ordinary businessmen. How do we find out where the Jews are? IBM, the solutions company, said, we have the solution. And indeed, there was no solution that IBM was not willing to give to the Nazis. IBM invented the racial census for the Nazis. Here we need to understand that the information age that you all are aware of, did not begin in Silicon Valley. It began in Berlin in 1933. And when I say the information age, I specifically mean the individualization of statistics. That is the information age. So IBM devised a racial census where they would punch in one column the religion, in a second column the mother tongue, in the third column the nationality, in the fourth column the profession, and the fifth column, the residence. Then at the rate of 24,000 cards per hour, like that, the Nazis know all the Jews of Polish extraction in Berlin engaged in the fur trade. Once Hitler said, we don't have the resources to undertake such a census, IBM said, and Watson specifically directed them to say, we will do it for you. We'll hire the people, we'll do the tabulation, we'll rent the facilities. Once the names were known, they were cross-tabulated against lists. The professors, the directory of professors, the directory of judges, the directory of doctors, the motor club, the gardening club, the phone book. And they could find out who were the Jewish judges, who were the Jewish doctors, who were the Jewish bankers, expel them. And then came the third phase, confiscation, get their assets. All the banks and financial institutions in Nazi Germany ran on Hollerith punch cards. Now we know their name. We've thrown them out of their job. We've made it impossible for them to work. And now we're going to seize their bank accounts. We're going to seize their insurance. We're going to seize their property. We're going to organize their assets. The fourth phase was ghettoization. IBM and its Hollerith punch card system was a master at moving people, tracking people, quantifying people. One day, everybody gets up, thrown out of their house, they know exactly where to go, they're sent over into ghettos, 5, 6, 7, 8 families into one cramped apartment, like that. Efficient, not only in one city, but in many cities, not only in one country, but in several countries around Europe. Deportation, the Jews sent on trains, like my mom was sent on a train. All the trains in Europe ran on IBM punch cards. I personally interviewed the Polish man who worked for the IBM process at 22 Pavia Strasse in Krakow, organizing the trains. They went to Auschwitz full, they came back empty. They went to Auschwitz full, they came back empty. They even organized the extermination of the Jews by creating and masterminding the extermination by labor campaign, where they would catalog all your skills. Are you a doctor? Are you a bricklayer? Are you a metal worker? Once they had your skills, they would cross-tabulate that against where they needed slave labor. They would move people across the country on special trucks and trains, on Hollerith lists. They would work them to death. And after they were worked to death, they would then have them gassed. And IBM had a code for that, too. In fact, the Auschwitz tattoo began as an IBM number.
Well, that's the Jewish-American author Edwin Black there. It's really taking us through the way that the computer technology, if you can call it that, the punch card technology, the Hollerith technology of IBM in the 1930s, was an essential ingredient of the Nazi genocide, Kevin.
Yeah, no, I've just been reading about Himmler, and IBM's role in the genocide is widely known now. For years they hid it. But it was the Nazis did the genocide. But IBM helped them.
It seems that we've kind of been almost programmed to accept the end of privacy.
Well, people, here's comes back to the media. People are told, oh, this is going to keep you safe. They're not told the truth, that this is going to create profiles of you. So that if your kids or whatever, or you do anything, we can nail you for something. There are certainly enough laws on the books, about 400,000. So the bureaucracy can get you if it has the information. And that's the catch. This is mass surveillance. The European court struck it down, and the British government has struck it up.
Even though we haven't actually left the EU yet. Martin, the other side of this, of course, is we've got this looming potential cyber attack. Jens Stoltenberg, the Director General of NATO, announced just after the Bilderberg conference here in Britain. Andrew Parker has also talked about this potential massive cyber attack a couple of weeks ago. And the thing is, there would be no way of knowing where the cyber attack has come.
But I think we could probably guess, using good old-fashioned coppers' hunches, that it's coming from inside our own intelligence structure. We're being set up here in lots of different ways. It's not just that the state is surveying us. That state is also engaged in criminal terroristic activities. And the surveillance is an integral part of manipulating us all in a certain kind of direction. And it's not just a question of them watching us.
Okay, I'll put the on the podcast of this. I'll put the Brave New World Aldous Huxley clip on there too. But it's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for St George, Steve Pearce. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and former Rich List journalist Kevin Kyle, author of Who Owns Britain. Dialects on Tuesday at noon. Our show page is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Don't let the banksters get you down.